It is 8:32, and we have with us live in the studios once again, just like the old days. It's just John Parrish from from Eat the State, co-editor of Eat the State. What would you do to Maria this week?
Well, you know, the irony is that she's down in Southern California getting a few days of sunshine and warmth and R&R. It's probably warmer and sunnier here. It's probably like 60 degrees and pouring down there.
Possibly. We don't know.
Yeah, so it's the joke's on her. But she'll be back next week, but she's off having a few days of well-earned vacation.
Yeah. Yeah, she doesn't get a lot of vacation with her job and such. So
yes, we do have day jobs. We don't sit around chronicling the misdeeds of the Bush administration for a living.
Right, right. So when people are like yelling at you about, you know, get a haircut and a job.
Yeah, exactly.
You only need to get a haircut.
That's it. Although, actually, I do now chronicle the Bush administration's misdeeds for a living, but Maria does not. So, anyway, but I am here and spent the morning wrestling with computer problems. So, I'm in a fine mood.
You are. You've got little pieces of printed circuit board all over you.
Yes, exactly, and profound ignorance because, of course, without a working computer, who knows what's going on in the world? I guess you have to rely on the radio and stuff.
Okay. Well, today's take is going to be a little different than what it usually is. Then, so this week there was passing of someone who has we've played on this station multiple times through alternative radio, Edward Said.
Yeah, and very sad to see his passing. I don't think a lot of people realized he'd been struggling with leukemia for like 12, 13 years. He'd been very ill for a long time. Remained incredibly prolific, both in academic circles and in the activist milieu, both in the United States and internationally. Very well-respected commentator in the Middle East, who actually was a very unpopular and despised figure among many of the authoritarian regimes of places like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Jordan. I mean, he's a man who is seen by people in the Middle East as a voice for freedom and democracy. And of course, here he was seen when he was viewed at all by establishment figures, it was as this, you know, annoying gadfly type. But I highly recommend any of his writings, and there's volumes of them to people out there. He's can be a little bit less than accessible sometimes, but he's very, very insightful, a very good commentator in the Middle East, and really right up until a few days and weeks before his death, he was still writing and still speaking out on the travesties of particularly U.S. policy toward Israel and Palestine in the Middle East, and how, you know, we're sowing the seed of a thousand regrets for many, many years to come in that region by what we're doing right now there. So very, very sad to see his passing. And it really, I think his death highlighted a couple things. It highlighted, number one, how marginalized a figure like that, who is seen as a very respected and fairly mainstream commentator in other parts of the world, is just so far outside the mainstream and outside the pale of where he should be in a political debate in this country, shows really how far removed political debate in this country is, particularly around issues of Israel and Palestine and now Iraq, compared to what the debate is in the rest of the world. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes when we talk about Bush at the UN regarding Iraq. But you see that all the time with U.S. media coverage of the actions of the Israeli government and Palestine and that particular conflict, and now this whole farce around the quote-unquote roadmap. There is no real replacement on the U.S. left for a figure like Said, who has the credibility to move back and forth between the Arab world and the English-speaking world, and to be highly articulate and very insightful in both worlds. We need to develop more figures like that who can offer those kind of critiques in a way that has credibility in both worlds.
Mm. I know he had just spoken in Kane Hall, University of Washington, just
a few months back.
Yeah.
And
which was so crowded and sold out so early that I couldn't even get in there to it.
They would let you in? Wow.
Okay, I didn't mean it quite that way, but you know, those minor press credentials that I have couldn't get me beyond the door. So.
No, and it really is ironic that here's a guy who's been, you know, fighting the good fight on behalf of all the right battles for like 30 years, and it was really just in the last, maybe 3 or 4 years, after he'd been, you know, fighting against leukemia for several years and going through treatments and all the rest of it, that it's sort of the Chomsky phenomenon, that you do this for all of your life, and then in your golden years, when you don't necessarily have the spring in your step to take advantage of it, then all the public attention and really adulation comes. But it was well deserved in his case.
Well, there were other developments in the Middle East. One of them in Israel this week. I mean, obviously, there's always tons of developments in Israel Palestine every week, but a significant one where a number of fighter pilots refused to fly any further missions. 27 pilots, I believe.
Yeah, and this this is a phenomenon that's been going on for a couple of years with a conscientious objector movement among Israeli reservists and active duty people. Now, bear in mind that the draft military service is compulsory in Israel, and not only is it compulsory, but it's, you know, really considered a right of manhood. It's really central to Israeli society in a lot of ways, in a way that it is not in this country. And so for people to step away from that is a real act of courage, because you're taking serious risks with things like social acceptance, future employment, things like that. But there has been a movement that really strikes to the core of Israeli government, and particularly Sharon government policy toward Palestine, that has been going on for the last several years, and particularly the last couple of years, the Refusnik movement. And these are people who are not saying we refuse military service, but specifically that we refuse to carry out orders against Palestinians, and we refuse to go into the West Bank and Gaza or the occupied territories. That Israeli policy there is not only immoral, but it's counterproductive. And, you know, this is something that more soldiers should be doing in Israel and the United States when they're given orders that are contrary to the Geneva Convention, which many of the orders given to Israeli soldiers are. I mean, we're talking about something that has been in an illegal military occupation for the last, 35, 36 years? We've had a couple of generations that have grown up and become adults and had kids and maybe grandkids at this point in the time that Israel has been illegally occupying this territory. And even though since the offensive of spring 2002, that conflict has largely disappeared from American news headlines. You have headlines every time maybe a suicide bombing goes off, but you don't have headlines for the steady one, two people a day, Palestinians or three or four or six who die. And you certainly don't have headlines for the thousands of daily humiliations and the arrests and the political prisoners and, you know, the widespread unemployment and the privation and, you know, all of the things that are that are fueling the gross imbalance when you have essentially a wealthy Western country that it's trying to expand right into and expropriate the resources from a very poor third world country, and they're claiming the same land. That conflict has not gone away, even though it is not in the U.S. headlines every day. And it is really the sort of steady drip, drip, drip of daily indignities that that is fueling that conflict, and that also is fueling the Refusnik movement. And, you know, really there is a far greater spectrum of debate within Israel itself over Israeli government policy toward Palestinians and things like the what has been called the apartheid wall that is being constructed now in Israel, and some of the policies that the Sharon government is enacting regarding the repatriation of families that are being separated out by government Israeli government policies. There's far greater debate over all of those things in Israel than there is in the American media. You know, you can go online and read a newspaper like like Haaretz, or even the Jerusalem Post that certainly have English language editions. And you get a much broader sense of the dynamics of internal politics in Israel than you do here. The Refusnik movement and the peace movement in Israel is alive and well. And it's something that we in this country need to be aware of and need to be supportive of. And the Palestinian solidarity folks in this country and in Seattle as well. There are still people, a la Rachel Corrie, who are going over and doing solidarity work all the time in Palestine. And, those are all things that we need to be aware of, because it's our tax dollars that are fueling that conflict just as much as it is in Iraq.
And it looks like Bush's roadmap to peace appears to be, it got water spilt on it or something. It doesn't
They refold it the wrong way, because it keeps showing war on the outer panels. And what's up with that? In many, many ways, that roadmap was a non-starter. You just have to look at the heat that Howard Dean took. And Dean has been in no way, shape, or form even a moderate on Israeli policy. I mean, he's pretty much of an Israeli hawk when it comes to that particular conflict and his views on it. At the same time, he took tremendous heat from Lieberman and several of the other Democratic presidential candidates and a number of the senators when he said a little while ago, it seems like such a common sense statement that it's ridiculous if the United States is going to be an arbiter in that conflict, then we need to stop being so one-sided in our treatment of the two sides. We can't sit here and being shoveling all the arms and giving all the money and the advisors to one side and not giving the time of day and demanding the ouster or the deaths of the other side and expect to be seen either by the public or by the negotiating parties as an impartial arbiter, because we're not. And that really is the fundamental reason why the roadmap was a non-starter and nobody really took it seriously. I mean, the extent that it was taken seriously is the extent to which everybody realizes that the United States has to sign off on something. And for that matter, the United States almost is the only party that can credibly initiate something for a peace process to work in Israel and Palestine. But in order to do that, the United States has to be willing to ask the Israeli government to make concessions, and particularly to pull back some, not just stop making more, but pull back some of the steadily expanding and illegal quote-unquote settlements, which are basically expropriations of land, further expropriations of land and property that are illegal under, every previous agreement that even the Israelis have made. So you have that going on. And it's not a surprise when you have the Israelis saying we're going to take out Arafat, and the United States saying, we're not going to deal with them. The roadmap was a joke in the first place. So what's happened in the last week or two, is just really more a confirmation of that than any great setback.
Right. Moving along, if that's a roadmap for Palestine, Israel, then Bush also tried to push his brochure in the UN for Operation Iraqi Freedom, and didn't get any takers.
Yeah, I think he forgot to put it in other languages or something other than Texan. And it was very interesting because, Bush went to the UN. He got a very cool reception, and Bush's speech was what got all the attention in the U.S., but in the rest of the world, what really got attention was that Jacques Chirac came on afterwards, and he was one of several international leaders who were in the United States this week. Vladimir Putin was in Washington on Thursday and Friday after the UN session as well, visiting with Bush. And
Musharraf Fox from Mexico.
We can talk about all sorts of, sure, of criminals that were in Washington this week. Chirac's speech, at which he basically said, if the international community is going to have a role in trying to undo the mess that the United States has made in Iraq, then it needs to have some control over how we clean up that mess. We're not simply going to shovel money and troops over to the Americans to make a further hash of things. And he got, repeat standing ovations in the United Nations, as opposed to Bush, who got the clap, 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 clap. And that was about it. Meanwhile, the sort of reason that Bush can get such a cool reception internationally, and you know, the Bush administration is desperate. The only card that they have to offer the international community is giving up some of the decision making and some of the control over what happens in the country of Iraq. They have, as we, as Maria and I have both talked about, and particularly Maria, week after week out in this program, they have no money with which to pay for the occupation. They can't get the oil fields to generate money. The pipelines keep getting blown up. The Iraqi government has no resources of its own. It doesn't even have there is no functioning government in many ways. Even the governing national council that the U.S. has set up, you know, in many cases they don't even have functioning offices yet, and they have to defer to the viceroy and to the American occupiers for all of their decisions, and then they go and dutifully carry out the decisions. 2 days before Bush goes to the U.N., the real news takes place. That is the announcement in Dubai, not in Baghdad, by the Iraqi foreign finance minister that the governing council, operating under the auspices of the White House, is going to essentially put the government of Iraq up for sale, to put the country of Iraq up for sale. You know, most public government operations in Iraq under Saddam Hussein were carried out by the government, as is true in most countries. And it was, you know, these privatized, nationalized companies that did all these various things. They were all put up for sale on Sunday, something like 192 of them. Basically, I mean, the lead sentence in both The Independent and The Guardian, the UK papers, where this was a major story, unlike the US, was the country of Iraq was put up for sale yesterday. And that's really what it was. It was the Bush administration setting up the rules by which all of these different companies, not the oil and gas sector of the country, but everything else from the, you know, setting up the cell phone system, which is primarily going to be used by the U.S. military, to, you know, to all the different public services that you would expect a government to carry out, and the utilities and all the rest of it, laying out, calling out for bids for corporations to come in and buy all these operations. And the terms by which they were laid out basically barred Iraqis from competing for many of these bids, like the cell phone bid, which is one of the largest of the lot. There was a requirement that the winning bidder have operated a cell phone network in another country. Well, how many Iraqis or companies are going to have done that? You know, basically it was set up so as to heavily favor the Halliburtons and the Bechtels of the world, the large corporations, particularly the American corporations, that are come in, loot Iraq of its resources, of its money. And it was done so with a tax holiday for the rest of the year, with a 15%, which is extremely low tax rate, on the corporations after that, with no requirements that they hire Iraqis, no limits, on the amount of money that can be taken out of the country. I mean, you know, none of the very basic limits that are put in place by almost every developing country in the world. This is a free market privatization scheme that is more extreme than any developing country anywhere in the world has ever undertaken. And it's what the Bush administration is doing in Iraq now, as quickly as they can, even before the finance minister has an office in Baghdad, because number one, he'll probably be assassinated this week as a result. But beyond that, because they want to have all the damage done and all the loot safely offshore before they have to give up some control of the decisions as to how post-invasion Iraq is going to be set up and structured. Because once the UN or whomever is in there with its troops, with its money, they're not going to allow these kind of outrages and this kind of systematic looting to take place, certainly not on those extreme terms. This is the Bush free market ideologues, who are the same people who pushed for this war, you know, trying to pay themselves and their friends off before the bills come due.
And obviously, the Iraqis aren't too jazzed about any of this, and that's where the guerrilla war seems to be coming from. And and then the U.S., in the meantime, until the U.N. comes in, needs to proposes to bring in more troops, because their guys are getting, you know,
Yeah, we saw headlines in the paper this morning that we have more reservists being called up from Washington State. Well, this is the butt end of the Bush administration policy toward Iraq, is that people are going to be disappearing from your workplace who are in the Army Reserve or whatever. People who are, you know, your neighbor's kid who thought he was getting a college education. They're going to wind up in Iraq for a year or two being shot at for, you know, trying to carry out duties they have not been trained for. And, you know, a few of them are going to come home in body bags, maybe more than a few, for the consequences of a policy that's fiscally immoral, that is not providing any basic services to the people of Iraq, but for whom the Bush administration's cronies are getting rich. And, you know, this is kind of a warm up for what they want to do in this country as well, but it's that much more extreme and illegal over there.
Well, they're going to get an education, all right. Let's jump to local news here for what time we have remaining. I saw in this morning's paper the never-ending Ethics and Election Commission seems to now be slapping Heidi Will's hands.
Yeah, and I mean, gosh, they're trying to shovel through these cases as fast as they can, but there's just so many of them. Heidi Wills, who is the most prolific fundraiser in the history of Seattle City Council, and that is not an exaggeration. She really is, and she's doing it again this year. She's up for her first first re-election. She raised like $250,000 in her bid for an open seat 4 years ago. She's exceeded that this year, even though she didn't do very well in the primary, so she'll probably redouble her efforts now. And part of the cash and carry politics that she and Jim Compton are making themselves known for was this Strippergate fiasco, where you know, there was this rezone vote that took place on a strip club in North Seattle, for which you know, they were heavily lobbied, and the family with longstanding felonious records who owns this place, you know, funneling donations to city council members through various assorted, you know, family members, family in probably several senses of the word, some of them Italian, and. The upshot was that they got their rezone vote. Well, this became public, and actually Rick Anderson at Seattle Weekly did a lot of the legwork on breaking it, and lo and behold, it comes back up before city council. And I mean, to some people, the fact that Heidi Wills took money for this wasn't the big thing. The big thing was that when it became public, she goes back and changes her vote. And you know, the rest,
which is true of everybody involved.
Yes, exactly. I mean, but you know, Heidi Wills paying $1,500 for Strippergate, you know, really is the tip of the iceberg. And we've talked about that on this station before, where you have, and even Jim Compton, I mean, you know, the Weasley little deal he struck, where he's not going to vote on Paul Allen's Vulcan Ventures matters for a year after he was caught taking jet rides down to see Paul Allen's basketball team on Paul Allen's jet just before voting on Paul Allen's businesses. And, you know, Vulcan Ventures has 8 full-time lobbyists up on City Hall. This is a little bit different than, you know, a strip club owner asking a 93-year-old former governor to, you know, to do him a favor to rezone a parking lot. This is the kind of cash and carry politics that you actually would see more of under a district system. And the same day, I believe, that we had the elections, we had the quiet news that we're going to have the initiative for going to an all-district form of electing city council on the ballot in November. It was initially thought they didn't have enough signatures to qualify. Now suddenly it's on the ballot, so it's going to be a very quick, you know, 6 or 7 week campaign to debate the merits of that. And you know, if you only have to be elected by business, well, the net result of that is that the Paul Allens of the world can pick these folks off one by one. And the reason that it's an all-district system that's going to be on the ballot in November rather than a mixed system, which was what was on the ballot in 95, where you have 3 people being at large, or however many being at large, voted at large by the whole city, and the rest being voted by ward or by district. Now you have all 9 in what we're going to be voting on in November being voted on by district. The reason for that is that the backers of the original measure, Jay Saucedo, who is a former Chong aide, and some other folks, went to Greg Nickels saying, what do we have to do to get your support on this? And Nickels said, I want all 9. I don't want to be the only citywide elected official. And so they change it to all nine. This measure in November, by and large, appears the way it does so as to give Greg Nichols and City and the 12th floor of City Hall much more power, and to give the mayor much more power and influence over City Council. That's what we're going to be voting on November, and we're going to be voting on a system where either he or people like Paul Allen or even your various stripper club or people like Heidi Wills and that these sort of cash and carry politics are going to become even more of a problem, not less of a problem than they have been with Heidi and Compton and folks like that now.
Is it still the 12th floor in the new building?
That's a good question. We'll have to figure that out later.
All right, we only have a couple minutes left, and there's a big ETS event coming up tomorrow night.
Yeah, there is. Eat the State, for folks who listen to this program with any regularity, know we've been putting out every week or every couple weeks for the last, we're in our eighth year now. We just celebrated our anniversary last week. And we do a little anniversary fundraising thing because it's perennially short of money. It's not a, you know, big paid staff and corporate office kind of thing. Very shoestring volunteer fueled. All of our editors and writers and all the rest of it are all volunteer. And we need money. So we're doing a 2,000 cent a head fundraising dinner. This is, of course, a play on George Bush having come to town a few weeks ago. And you can raise money, by goodness, so can we. It's at the home of Joe Swaya and Deb Morrison tomorrow night over in Ravenna. I don't even have the address in front of me. But if you can call the ETS hotline and RSVP at area code 206-903-9461. We will have some music there, Jim Page and others. We will have good food. We will have the ETS editorial and volunteer crew there for you to meet and hobnob with, and you can rub elbows. And we don't have a Lincoln bedroom that you can sleep in, but you know, we have all the other perks that you would expect. So tomorrow night,
you have the Swaya bedroom.
Yes, we have. I don't know if they'll be renting that.
I don't think
they
want you in there.
Yeah, you know, we again, or you can just send in donations also, certainly. But we would love to have you. We'd love to see you tomorrow night. Have a good time. I think it's 5 to 8 p.m. There's details on the website at ETS. www.eatthestate.org, and or you can give the call number and RSVP, and we'll call you back with the address off the air.
And there's an event starting this morning at 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock down at Victor Steinbrook, I believe.
I think it's Victor Steinbrook. We announced it at the 7:30 hour. And,
oh, dear. And
darn if I can still remember it.
I'm
Gene Buskin's
sure.
calendar is a great place to get information.
www.scn.org/activism/calendar is a great calendar source for all your peace and social justice, mm-hmm. and in this case, largely labor events that are happening around town.
That's always my first choice, but a nice backup is SeattleActivism.org.
Yes, that's a very good website also that's just started up in the last 6-7 months, so yeah. Many people may not know about it. SeattleActivism.org.
And then, of course, Eat the State, the print edition. There seems to be a slight lag on getting that.
Part of it is that the web edition is that we're in the middle of a redesign of the website,
okay.
Which people who have visited the website recently and have seen it in the past know about it. But we have a handful of stalwart web people who are doing all of that at the same time. So it seems to be a little slow getting the web version of the print edition up. But it is available free where you find books, you know, free newspapers and bookstores and cafes and what that around town.
All right.
A couple weeks.
All right. So we'll talk to you next week then.
And Maria will be back too.
Very good.